Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, July 24th, 2003. Today's session is What You Can Do for the Earth on Jubilee. Nothing. A Bible study presented by Ben Stewart. The number is STB 2003-02. Let's listen in.
I'm Ben Stewart, and I serve here as the pastor, and we're going to talk about Jubilee today, as it's the Jubilee Day at Holden that we have every summer. And it begins, this whole Jubilee business begins in a book that I doubt many of us have much devotional history with. How many of you spend a lot of time kind of devotionally reading the book of Leviticus?
No.
And, you know, I'm in some ways the wrong person to have up here, because not only do I not know much about Leviticus, but the Older Testament itself is mostly foreign territory to me. I usually feel a little like I don't know much what I'm doing. So I'm going to tell you just about everything I know about Leviticus today. But we're going to start with something a little more familiar than Leviticus. We're going to go back actually to the very beginning of the Bible in Genesis, something that you know a little bit more. But before we do that, there are biblical scholars, many of them, who say that this obscure passage from Leviticus that we're going to look at today forms, if not a major part, perhaps even the cornerstone of Jesus' ministry and his self-understanding of what he's up to in the world. So it might do us well to get a little familiar with this weird, obscure Jubilee passage from Leviticus. But let's start, before we go to the strange land of Leviticus, let's go to something we know more familiar, Genesis chapter 1. You can turn there if you want to, but some of this you probably even know in your hearts. The story of the first story of creation in Genesis, we get the 7 days of creation. When I was growing up in Sunday school, the way I learned this story, the crown of creation, the great culminating act, the final thing created in creation was, what was it for you guys? I don't know. What was the last and most glorious piece of creation?
People,
yes. Janet's been here too long. Yeah, right. The people. I mean, the animals, that's nice. The earth, that's nice. But man, when it really comes down to it, it's those people that get created. Of course, we have some affection for people. That's what we are. But the seventh day, the great day, the holy day of creation, the crown of creation, isn't so much people. It's the Shabbat. It's the Sabbath. It's the day when even God rests. And God does nothing. And it's the day that God says, this is holy. And I want you, people, to do the same thing. I want you, on your seventh day, to rest, just like I did. And that's the most holy thing you can do, is just rest and enjoy it. Some of the Sabbath tradition apparently developed when the people of Israel were in Babylon. Babylon also had a day of rest. It was their seventh day. But they were kind of superstitious people, they said, you don't want to do anything on the seventh day because it's unlucky. And if you try to do anything, it just won't work because the gods are against you. And so what you need to do is just sit around and do nothing because you're kind of in fear of what might happen to you. And while, if you can picture the people of Israel there in Babylon telling this creation story, saying, no, the earth is so good. The earth is so very good that when God came to the seventh day, God said, I'm going to do nothing but just enjoy this. I'm just going to enjoy what this beautiful, good, very good world is. Not, I'm scared of this very bad world. So, seventh day, God rests. And when does the day begin for the Jewish people?
Friday.
It begins in the night, right. So if you picture this day of rest, it doesn't begin maybe the way we would do it. You know, waking up in the morning, today I will do nothing. Every day in the Jewish calendar begins with this little Sabbath of going to bed. So if you think about it, in the Jewish calendar, very, very different than the way Western go-getter people do. You know, we begin our day, usually when the alarm clock goes off and it's time for work. They begin and they say, well, the day's beginning. Let's all go to bed and do nothing. Let's just rest. So that that every day begins with God's activity. Wounds are sewn up by healing in the nighttime. The earth kind of recovers from what people have done to it. Our own bodies are renewed by sleep. So even every day, not just the Sabbath, begins, first of all, with doing nothing. Okay. So we know Sabbath, we know that. Let's see. When I was in Jerusalem, there was something. People actually still keep Sabbath, especially some of the very religious Jews. And in the hotel where we were in, on Sabbath day, we were in the lobby, and I noticed the elevator door was just going open, ding. And it closed, and a little while, and open, ding. And they have it so that elevators in buildings just automatically go floor to floor on the Sabbath day, so you don't even have to push a button. So you can just walk in and kind of just stand there, and it'll just take you. So, kind of a beautiful thing. Okay, so the idea with Sabbath is do nothing and trust the goodness of God. Just, you know, it's not that big for a day. We can all do that. I want to read one poem, I think, by James Wright, an Ohio poet. But this is, I think, begins to get into some of the stuff of how this doing nothing business can actually be something radical and change the way that we think about life. This is called Lying in a Hammock at William Duffy's Farm in Pine Island, Minnesota. Dear to people. Over my head, I see the bronze butterfly asleep on the black trunk, blowing like a leaf in green shadow. Down the ravine behind the empty house, the cowbells follow one another into the distances of the afternoon. To my right, in a field of sunlight between two pines, the droppings of last year's horses blaze up into golden stones. I lean back as the evening darkens and comes on. Chicken hawk floats over looking for home. I have wasted my life. I think what James Wright is talking about here is that here is this experience of doing nothing, just for a moment, laying back in a hammock, and suddenly things come into clear focus. What has been important and what have I wasted? So if you think of this as Sabbath, as Saturday, perhaps Sunday morning when he wakes up, his life is going to be lived differently because he's done nothing on this Sabbath. Okay, so first Sabbath. Now I'm not going to go into, we're going to start with this basic layer of Sabbath. You know that, weekly thing, weekly day of rest. Every 7 years, though, in the Jewish tradition is a Sabbath year. It's the seventh year. You can read about it later if you want to. Exodus 23:10-11. You don't farm the land. Whatever happens to come up, that's what you eat. You don't work on it. And the idea is also that poor people can just come and take whatever food they need from wherever it is. Also, wild animals. You're not allowed to keep them. The wild animals can come in, eat your crops, and the language is always, God will provide for you. There's enough. Just let the land lie fallow. And then also, if you want to look at the Sabbath year thing, in Deuteronomy 15, debts are forgiven. If somebody owes you money, every 7 years in Jewish history, you just let them go. You just say, well, you don't owe me money anymore. It's all done. And slaves are released. If someone has kind of indentured themselves to you because they've fallen on hard times, hey, I'll be your servant because I owe you this money. Every 7 years, you say, you're free to go. And in Deuteronomy 15, it says, not only do you let them go, but take some animals out of your herd and take some food out of your granary and give it to them. Don't just let them go, but give them a good place to start. So we get Sabbath, day of rest, do nothing. Every 7 days, you get a day of rest to let everything just sit. Every 7 years, Israel says, we're going to let the land lay fallow, the poor are going to eat, the wild animals are going to eat our stuff, we're going to forgive debts and let our slaves go. Okay. So, we're going to like multiply this up to get to Jubilee. Okay. So you get seven times, let's just read, a little bit. We're going to go to that great devotional book of Leviticus. Leviticus 25. And if you're interested later on in reading about that sabbatical year every 7 years, you can read the first seven verses. But we're going to start at verse 8. Leviticus 25, verse 8. And does somebody want to read, how about 8 through 12? You got that?
You shall count off 7 weeks of years, seven times 7 years, so that the period of 7 weeks of years gives 49 years. Then you shall have the trumpet sounded loud on the 10th day of the 7th month, on the Day of Atonement. You shall have the trumpet sounded throughout all your land. And you shall hallow the 50th year, and you shall proclaim liberty throughout the land to all its inhabitants. It shall be a jubilee for you. You shall return, every one of you, to your property, and every one of you to your family. That 50th year shall be a jubilee for you. You shall not sow or reap the aftergrowth or harvest the unpruned vines. For it is a jubilee. It shall be holy to you. You shall eat only what the field itself produces.
Okay. Cool. So that's how you calculate the jubilee. You get this up. A week of 7 years, seven times 7 years, 49, and then you add that last year becomes the 50th year. And that's actually, incidentally, because you don't get it, today is about the 50th day of open summer season. So you count it off a week of weeks, not a week of years. And so what happens in there? Everybody, what are the people supposed to do? You shall return, what is this business? Yeah, return to your family property. Does anyone know what that's about? What's going on there?
Sounds like a family reunion.
A family reunion, yeah. Yeah. What would it be like in the United States if Native Americans had a family reunion with their family? Yeah, it would be a little disruptive. Yeah, we'll get to some more of that stuff in a little bit. But you can kind of see there's a radical sense of redistribution of property here. Every 50 years, you're going to go back to your family land. And if you in 50 years have acquired someone else's property, you just go back to your own homeland and you just give it up. And they come back and live there. Amazing stuff. Okay. So you can look at this stuff later if you want to. Verses 13 through 18 kind of gives you the details because people start to get, you know, foxy about this stuff. And so how is that going to work? If you know Jubilee is coming, how are you going to buy and sell your land? And the counsel here that Leviticus gives you is you don't buy and sell the land. You're basically renting it until Jubilee comes, and then you're going to get off it anyway. You know what I'm saying? So you only sell people, if you're going to sell people the land, you sell them up to Jubilee. You don't try to buy it in perpetuity. So then there's this other little thing here. Why don't somebody read verses 19 through 22? And we're gonna go back and hear Jesus say some words very close to this in a little bit.
The land will yield its fruit, and you will eat your fill and live on it securely. Should you ask, what shall we eat in the seventh year, if we may not sow or gather a crop? I will order my blessing for you in the sixth year, so that it will yield a crop for 3 years. Did you say 21 or 22?
When do you read the 22? Actually, read the 24.
When you sow in the eighth year, you will be eating from the old crop until the ninth year. When its produce comes in, you shall eat the old. The land shall not be sold in perpetuity, for the land is mine. With me, you are but aliens and tenants. Throughout the land that you hold, you shall provide for the redemption of the land.
So that first part that Janet read is saying, is God kind of saying, hey, I know this can be a little nerve-wracking not to plant your crops on there. But I want you to trust. I'm going to provide enough on that land, and you'll be able to eat from it. Don't work. Do nothing. Okay? I want you to trust me on this one. And then there's that theological basis. in land, or in verses 23 and 24. You don't own the land. You don't own the land. It shall not be sold in perpetuity. With me, you're just a renter. You're just a tenant. And God says, kind of, I'm holding it in trust for the poor. So don't think that you own the land. People can always come back. Then there's this big old honking long section from 25 through 55 that has a lot of details. I'm going to pull out two sets of them, starting with this verse 28. This is talking about if somebody, you know, if somebody wants to kind of come back and redeem the land that they've lost to you, what should they do? If there's not sufficient means to recover the land, to buy it back from you, what was sold shall remain with the purchaser until the year of Jubilee. And the year of Jubilee, it shall be released, and the property shall be returned. Can't buy it? Okay, I'll hold on to it until Jubilee. But in every 50 years, you're going to get your land back. You're not going to be shoved off the land. And then down here on verse 39, this is speaking to the Jewish people. If any who are dependent on you become so impoverished that they sell themselves to you, you shall not make them serve as slaves. They shall remain with you as hired or bound laborers, kind of indentured servants, and they shall serve with you until the year of Jubilee. And then they and their children with them shall be free from your authority. They shall go back to their own family and return to their ancestral property. For they are my servants, whom I brought out of the land of Egypt, and they shall not be sold as slaves or sold. There's a lot of details around this, surrounding this stuff in Leviticus. But God is basically saying, you know, you all were slaves in the land of Egypt, and I delivered you with a mighty hand. Don't go back to Egypt ways. You know, I want you now to live as free people.
Which is one of the other reasons for Sabbath rest, is in Deuteronomy, is it not, too? Because we were slaves,
yeah.
We rest.
Yeah, we rest.
And the creation, the two reasons for
yes, me. Beautiful. Yeah. Yeah, there's this strong sense of we're not going back to Egypt. We're not going to go back to those ways. So what I want to do now, I want to throw this out there and let us then all kind of stir this up, is look at how this bit, how we can maybe think of this Jubilee business in kind of a simplistic way, first of all, as doing nothing. And probably as achieving people who have made it up to Holden Village and live in North America, doing nothing is one of the hardest things for us. And I think Jesus has this way of looking at doing nothing that and we might be worried that it looks like laziness. But I think we're going to see that this can be quite radical. First of all, we should look. People probably know. We heard it last night. We'll hear it again tonight in the Eucharist. Luke 4, what is it, 16? Somebody want to read 18 through 19?
The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to preach good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release to the captives and recovering of the sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed, to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord.
And then I'll just skip down here to, you know, everybody's looking at Jesus, and Jesus says, today this scripture has been fulfilled in your hearing. Most biblical scholars think that on that verse 19, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor, Jesus is saying, this is the day of Jubilee. This is what's going on. I'm proclaiming this. And it's been fulfilled in your hearing. Jubilee is going to happen now. And if you look at all those things that he's quoting from Isaiah, good news to the poor, release to the captives, recovery of sight to the blind, that's not even, but let the oppressed go free. These are all things that happen in the Jubilee. So, Jamie was just talking to me last night about the Lord's Prayer, and she said, you know, I like going back to the language that I learned in my youth of, forgive us our debts. because that's really the language that's going on there. Sins is, it sounds very theological. We know what sins are. But the word is debts, and it's very much monetary. It can also mean sins. But forgiving debts, and the word in Greek, aphemi, means really to do nothing. It can also mean neglect. It can also mean walk away or leave or let go. So we think of forgiving. In some ways, it is kind of a jubilee thing, a Sabbath thing of doing nothing. Somebody has harmed me, and I'm not going to come back at them with all this energy. I'm going to let go. Third world country owes our country a lot of money. We're not going to come after them with the World Bank collection agency. We're going to let go. Just do nothing. Let's see. And you know, if you think about a lot of the way Jesus counsels people to forgive, he often does use this number 7, which I just think is interesting. How often should I forgive? 70 times 7? All these kind of jubilee numbers come creeping in as he talks about it. One of the discussion things I'd like to have us do is what would it mean for us to live like this? Because apparently Jesus is saying this is the way to live your life all the time now, in a jubilee lifestyle. If we are going to live this jubilee, the release of debts, the forgiveness of debts, and the freeing of slaves, who today in America would be enslaved or for us? Who would be the folks that we would release from captivity? Can you think of who those might be?
Ourselves.
Ourselves? How so?
I know Orthodox Jews who really take the Sabbath seriously. In traveling on business, when sundown comes, it's immediate check into a motel and not to travel any further. We speak the words, but how many of us mow our lawns on Sundays with the excuse, oh, I find this very relaxing, or it's my way of being peaceful? We're kidding ourselves, and we more than anybody else need to be released.
Yeah, so ourselves, we can do nothing day. Yeah. And sometimes we're slaves to a lawnmower or something. Yeah.
Yeah. Or writing checks, yeah. Or 18,000 other things. Right. And we talk but seldom to see it lived out.
Beautiful, yeah. Who else? What else? Who's enslaved? Or what debts might be forgiven?
Not the Afro-Americans.
Oh, yeah. Wow, African-Americans. What ways do you think about that happening?
Well, there's lots of things that are still in equality and not equal in terms of their living conditions,
right.
And their employment, their education, and lots of things could be balanced.
Yeah.
That isn't.
Yeah. You know, people have tried to, you know, say if we took all the money that slaves produced in this country, you know, how much would that be and how much of it has been repaid? We make a different slant on things like affirmative action today. Yeah. Yeah. Because, you know, we're all going to start from a level playing field. Well, that's going to take a few jubilees to get us back to a level playing field. Yeah.
I work for the Employment Security Department, and I think there's a lot of slavery in the wage that a lot of people make in this country and all over the world. There's
yeah.
a menial job, menial wages, sweatshops.
Yeah.
So the whole employment disparity of wages is a slavery of its
yeah,
own.
Absolutely. Yeah. Rebecca gave a forum last night on farm workers. And that's one thing, but while you're here, sometimes you'll hear announcements of this salad or these berries or this fruit comes from our friends at Sunny Pine Farms. We try to establish relationships with growers so that we know where our food is coming from. Becca had a pretty powerful forum last night that told us about where a lot of the stuff that we're just going in the supermarket to pick up, how much money are people making and what are the living conditions like and are they very different than slaves? Interesting stuff. You've got some information up there in the dining room.
The dining area.
Also, I think on a personal basis, a lot of times, at least what I see in ministry, single parents. I see caregivers of Alzheimer's. All of those people are really in bondage in some sense. Enslaved.
And I was just thinking about children who come from single parent families or have to spend a weekend here and a week here, or a day here and a day there, or having learning disabilities, just in bondage, or social skills. I was with 95 middle school kids a couple weeks ago at a camp, and there's a big disparity between those who are socially able to connect and those who are just kind of wander off by themselves or enslaved, even as children.
And there's this, then you can connect to this biblical counsel of there's this this image of doing nothing, but also we don't just let people just be free, but help them as they help them to be free on their own. Supply them with things from your herd. What would you can imagine what those things might look like.
The since 9/11, I think that Islamic people, you'd be freed from this blanket suspicion just because of who they are.
Just, I don't know if anybody knows this. I just found out yesterday reading in Christian Century at the Lutheran World Federation that's going on right now. Many of our sisters and brothers from the Southern Hemisphere have been unable to attend because of the refusal of visas because they're dark-skinned people. And the assembly is quite upset. I mean, many of people from Africa, from Asia, have been unable to get in because of this kind of blinding suspicion.
Also, quite literally, there are millions of people that are enslaved, literally, by debt and predatory lending, and even which is check cashing stores in inner cities, 400% interest rates, and that's on the far end continuum. But even middle class folks with high levels of credit card debt, this is a major issue in our country. Yet it underpins our economic system. So what's the implication of this? What are we saying?
And a lot of these things that we're talking about really are based on the way powerful people, many like us, are trying to hold on to things. Hold on to our security, hold on to our economics. And this text is, this Jubilee stuff is encouraging us to let go and simply do nothing for a while, and then work for justice. So we've got release of debts and slaves. I wanted to get in, I didn't have time to get in here. Justin Martyr, our youngest son, is named after one of the earliest church historians, has this beautiful passage about forgiving enemies and how he was seeing in the people of the early church the embodiment of the prophetic hope that swords would be beaten into plowshares. Because he said, we once were just simply Jews, but now we are people from all over the world forgiving our enemies. And we not only to simply tolerate each other, but we actively forgive each other and actively love and let go of the things against us. We don't swallow each other anymore. And I think a refusal to serve war is a way of letting go, of saying, in the words of Edna Vincent Millay, I will die, I may die for you, but that's all I'm gonna do for you, death. I'm not gonna go kill other people in the name of protecting myself or something. I want to go over just a couple of these more things and see if you've got ideas for them. Sharing the land, letting people return to their homeland. We already mentioned African Americans. What would it look like if African Americans were able to return to their land? Maybe Africa's not where they're able to return to since they were stolen from there. But what would it look like really to enact that? Or Native Americans, my goodness. What's that look like? And then, in the sabbatical year, think about the wild animals getting to come and eat the food of our fields. So what would it look like to declare amnesty on the land for wild animals? There's a guy in Chicago, a member of my dad's congregation, who was talking about the environmental disaster of how many deer were on their nuclear power plant and eating all the shrubbery around. And I thought, oh, this is really a strange take on this. Whose land is it? Here at Holden, we have to work on this a lot, of doing nothing, letting the wilderness just be. And it's a beautiful thing out past that wilderness boundary. You can't take power tools out there. You can't take a bicycle. So the trail crews have to use, often just kind of do nothing. But when they do use tools, they have to use these very simple tools and use their bodies. I had a quick list here of sharing the land, things that might take real work and faith. Lobbying and advocacy on behalf of kind of debt relief that some people will be writing letters for today. Divestment, getting our money out of things that are actively kind of stealing land from other people. A little thing I did in college, my grandpa gave me stock that was, he gave me some in an energy company that was doing some nasty things in North Carolina, and he gave me some nasty stock. He was doing some stuff in South Africa. And so I sold it and gave it to Greenpeace. It wasn't that much money or anything, but it was just, I'm going to let go of this junk. Living within kind of small means to let other people share the land with us, building Habitat for Humanity houses. Think of Julia Butterfly Hill sitting up in a tree, doing nothing for, what, a year or more? Just to let the wild things be there. And I think of Rachel Corey, this woman from Tacoma, who went over to do nothing in Palestine, to stand in front of houses that were being bulldozed by the Israeli army with American bulldozers, and was killed, was flattened by a bulldozer. And so here's a woman who was doing nothing, just standing there asking people to share the land with the Palestinians, and was killed by this bulldozer and kind of became a martyr to this faith. So doing nothing can also be pretty radical and pretty costly. What are some other things? Ideas about sharing the land with those who've been dispossessed of everything?
I was going to tell you about this really neat project that's going on with the Great Plains Restoration Council. And it comes out of, it's a couple of native tribes in South Dakota and in Texas that have gotten together and trying to create a safe passageway for the buffalo through the Great Plains from Canada, like from the northern part of Saskatchewan all the way down into Mexico. Wow. With the idea that if you reintroduce buffalo to the land, like the buffalo know how to restore it. And they're really like intelligent, especially ecologically. They know what prairie grasses to eat. And giving the buffalo sort of the chance to reclaim that that short grass prairie that has been just demolished by agribusiness and stuff. And so as the counties in the West or become frontier counties instead of being populated and gaining more population, they're losing population. They're as sparsely populated as they've been since the turn of the century. The land values are going down, and these folks are able to buy up the land. And so they're partnering with Ted Turner and with other folks, and so churches can buy like little segments of land and then donate it to the Great Plains Restoration Council. But it's, and then giving, using that too to bring Native youth out there and to teach them how to take care of the buffalo again, how to live on the land. And it's just a really amazing project that's just getting going.
Great Plains Restoration Council.
And so I see so much hope in that, like the dialogue that can come out of that between white folks, white farmers, and native tribes who are often at odds, and then ecologically, it's just a really, really beautiful example too. So.
Thanks.
Yeah.
I think that's also called Buffalo Commons.
It's building on Buffalo Commons. Frank and Deborah Popper, Frank is on the board of that, but
Other Jubilee sharing.
I'm a member of Western Wisconsin Conservancy, which is helping farmers let their land go back to natural crops.
Let it lie fallow.
Mm-hmm. And the wetlands, especially.
Oh, cool. Yeah. This sharing the land, it's interesting to see how this is connected with families returning to the land, the people who used to live there. is connected with this kind of letting the land be, just letting it lie fallow. There's an interesting study that was done the week after September 11, 2001. The climate of North America cooled off. They think it's because we didn't have the greenhouse-inducing contrails of all the airplanes. It's the first time for that long that we've not had air traffic. So all those trails that are left are contributing to greenhouse effect. And just everybody just doing nothing cooled off our continent measurably, which is kind of an amazing, and I mean, tragic at the same time, but kind of hopeful of what might be. Other ideas of letting the land rest.
Well, I think the truth is most of us are probably city people. I don't know. I sure am. And so part of it, I think, is what is our city urban lifestyle like? And the use of oil in cars and big cars that get very low mileage and that we jump into to run to Target to buy some, you know, hair gel or something.
Yeah.
Just our use of the land in our urban lifestyles is a huge thing, including how we eat and what food we eat and where we buy it from. But
I lived in a Jewish neighborhood in Columbus, Ohio, and on the Sabbath, you would see people, everybody's walking. Everybody was driving.
Yeah. New York
and,
City too.
Yeah.
My sister lives in Upper West Side Manhattan, and Manhattan on Saturday is a different community than it is the other six days of the week.
Synagogues don't have very good parking lots. It's
because
kind
of the Jewish
It's
interesting.
Yeah. And I mean, and you could think of that little thing of just kind of doing nothing. I think I'll not drive to blah blah blah. Where that can lead. I mean, what has our country's kind of anxious need for oil led us to? I mean,
think about it.
You know, maybe if we did nothing and practiced this, we wouldn't need to go drill in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge for more oil. Maybe we wouldn't need to spend $500 million a year protecting an American oil pipeline in Colombia with paramilitary troops that are committing human rights abuses. And maybe we wouldn't need to invade Iraq. What could we do with the money that we spend protecting America's oil supply around the world? Somebody, you know, even has these statistics on if we didn't eat ice cream for a year, we could buy.
I know.
It's getting close to going there. We could knock out, you know, major childhood diseases all over the world. You know, with that amount of money, just by doing nothing. So, and this then, you know, I want to wrap up here, but like, let me show you a good book, too. If you want to read more about Jubilee, it's a little bit dated, but John Howard Yoder's The Politics of Jesus has a lot of good stuff in here about Jubilee. And then what he'll do is a lot of the stuff that we hear is just kind of, head in the clouds, kind of nice stuff about Jesus saying, don't worry about what you shall eat or what you will wear. For God knows that you need these things. That sounds very much like the counsel God gives in Leviticus. When the people are worried, what are we going to do about letting the land lie fallow? God says, I'll provide enough. There will be enough. So don't worry about it. And Jesus is saying these same things continuously about forgiveness of sins, forgiveness of enemies, and not having so much personal stuff, about selling your possessions and giving the money to the poor. So don't worry. They'll be enough. And let's see. I think I want to read another poem. This is a William Stafford poem that to me is another just a beautiful Sabbath or Jubilee image of people doing nothing and land doing nothing and it being beautiful. This is called At the Unnational Monument Along the Canadian Border. This is the field where the battle did not happen, where the unknown soldier did not die. This is the field where grass joined hands, where no monument stands, and the only heroic thing is the sky. Birds fly here without any sound, unfolding their wings across the open. No people killed or were killed on this ground, hallowed by neglect and an air so tame that people celebrate it by forgetting its name. So, Leviticus, Jesus, have all these images of doing nothing on the Sabbath, beginning each day, remember, with the night of doing nothing. And living our lives, it's often finding a solution in just not doing anything. And it becomes not this kind of head in the clouds thing, but a real radical way of loving this good creation, this created good. And will call us eventually to action. I mean, come back here at 10:45 to hear John Martin talk about the way that we can be called into action, to do nothing, to let go of debts and things like that. But anyway, so I hope that this can be a little bit of help to begin for all of us in our hyperactive, over-consuming culture to learn this gift of Sabbath and Sabbath year and Jubilee. So go in peace, do nothing.